Spiked is free, and it always will be. There's no paywall, no subscriptions. We want to reach as many people as possible. But to do that, we need your help. If you support the work that we do here, why not become a regular donor? Just £5 per month will keep us going, even in these uncertain times. To do so, just go to spiked-online.com and click on the big red donate button. Whatever you can give is greatly appreciated, especially given all that's going on in the world. Thanks so much, and now on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, a Spiked podcast. This is a show all about freedom, liberalism, the nanny state and censorship. And these days, there's a lot about coronavirus too. In this episode, we discuss how white working class boys became the forgotten demographic, Boris Johnson's public health kick, and the culture war over masks. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater and today I'm joined as ever by Chris Snowden, the author of Killjoys and a new ebook, Polemics. Hello Chris, how are you doing?
Hello Tom, hello everybody.
And today we're delighted to be joined by Spiked's editor, Brendan O'Neill. Hello Brendan.
Hi Tom.
So to kick things off, let's talk about white working class boys. So there's been a lot of discussion recently about inequality and how to tackle it, but there's been precious little discussion about the fact that of all groups in society, it is white working class boys who are the worst performing, certainly in terms of education. And this was the subject of a Spectator cover piece that Chris wrote a few weeks back, exploring how this forgotten demographic came to be so forgotten. So Chris, to kick things off, can you just give us a sense of sort of on what measures white working class boys are falling behind and why you think that is?
Educational measures, basically. I mean, after these kids leave school, it's quite difficult actually to track what happens to them. I mean, we know there are left behind areas. We know that suicide rates are much higher amongst men and this kind of thing. But in terms of like hard data, it's really just GCSE results, A-levels, and who's going to university. And the white British per se, you know, never mind boys or working class, are going to university at a lower rate than every other ethnic group apart from gypsies. Same applies to GCSE results. And this hasn't always been the case. And things are even worse if you're a boy and if you're on free school meals, which I kind of use as a proxy for working class, which isn't ideal, but still. So it depends how you look at it. If you're a kind of glass half full person, you can say it's great that all these kind of immigrant communities are doing so well. And let's try and learn from, for example, the Chinese. You know, why are Chinese girls got incredibly good marks in their exams? On the other hand, you could say, why is this very large disadvantaged minority being left behind? Either way, I think there are things we can do and lessons we can learn. I don't know exactly what they are, to be quite honest with you. I just thought it was worth putting the statistics out there because I think they go against the prevailing narrative of white privilege and, you know, how men rule the world. And it hasn't always been like this. And the gap's growing, and it's growing between men and women as well. 57% of people going to university now are female. It's a big gap. It hasn't always been that way, you know? And I think I remember, I don't know if I'm misremembering, but I think I remember the year when girls' A-levels were better than boys. Mm. It was quite a while ago. But that was considered a big achievement. And I guess equality of that kind is an achievement. But now there seems to be an overcorrection. I guess that's one of the points in the article. There's been an overcorrection. And the thing that really annoys me, which I mentioned in the article, are quotas. You can't legally call them quotas. You have to call them targets, but they are quotas in all but name. And so the BBC, for example, has a target of having 15% of its employees and management being BAME by, well, ASAP, actually, which I think it has comfortably achieved. And after or during the Black Lives Matter protests, it came out and said, we're going to increase this to 20%. You know, for no reason. It was just a gesture to show solidarity with BLM, as so many corporations are doing. But the simple fact of the matter is that, you know, BAME people do not make up anywhere near 20% of the population. They don't make up anywhere near of the working age population, you know, possibly in London. They do, but the BBC is supposed to be reaching out of London, right? And it's the same with their LGBT target of 8%. Only about 2% of the population are LGBT. And it has a similar target for women, which is simple 50-50. They want 50% of women to be in management and workforce, which on the face of it sounds fair until you realize that only 40% of the labor force is made up of women. So at every point in practice, you're going to have some kind of subtle or not so subtle discrimination against people for being straight, white and male.
Brendan, what's your take on all this?
I think Chris's piece is fascinating and the statistics are illuminating and depressing in equal measure. At the same time, it's not particularly surprising because this kind of thing has been developing for a long time. The kind of the ousting of working class people from so many areas of public life and spheres of influence has been going on for quite a long time. I remember Michael Collins wrote a very good book in 2005, I think, called The Likes of Us, which was just about the media discussion in the aftermath of the murder of Stephen Lawrence in the 90s. And he just did a really good overview of the extent to which the working classes, particularly the white working class male, was just held in contempt in contemporary society. And he traced that really interesting shift from white working class blokes in particular going from being the salt of the earth to the scum of the earth. And I think that's really what's happened over the past 30 years or so. And it's fascinating and worrying. It coincides, all this stuff that Chris has written about and which a few people have been raising concerns about. Of course, it coincides, as Chris says, with the idea of white privilege. So you have this completely surreal situation where educational statistics demonstrate that white working class males are doing pretty bad in comparison with other groups. But all that we talk about in mainstream media and political life too are the ideas of white privilege, male privilege. And it really shows how cut off that kind of discussion has become from reality. The thing we're talking about might be a very long-term problem that's been growing for a long time, which is why I share Chris's caution about coming up with easy pat solutions to this. I mean, I really do think what we're witnessing is the end result of working class communities losing their power and losing their clout. You think back to the 50s, 1940s, 1950s, I mean, working class communities, they had trade unions, they had working men's clubs, they had real influence in society, they had a seat at the table, and they were moving into more and more areas of public life, including into politics, culture. If you look at the 1960s, popular culture is dominated by working class blokes. They really had made a move into the center of public life in some ways. And then that starts to fall apart in the 70s and the 80s with the collapse of those kinds of institutions and the decay of working class power. And over time, bit by bit, they just become increasingly sidelined. Their aspirations are completely crushed. They're told they're not really up to much. You know, what's the point of going to school if you're a white working class kid? You won't come to much. And lo and behold, the media discussion or the popular representation of that section of society becomes more and more hostile. You know, they're just chavs, they're scum, they're troublemakers. So I think what we're witnessing in the current troubles facing that section of society is really the end result of something that's been growing for a few decades in terms of sometimes the quite conscious sidelining of working class communities and the replacement of any discussion of class politics with this myopic obsession with identitarianism and race and gender.
Chris, I just want to ask you about the question of kind of positive action, which is this kind of euphemistic way in which we do positive discrimination in this country, as you explain in the article, because there has been a bit of a move, particularly some people in the Tory party, Ben Bradley, Mansfield MP, you reference, to kind of treat this almost as a case that white working class boys are almost like a minority that needs to receive this kind of treatment. You talk about the Brian Thwaites case where he wanted to give money to Dulwich and Winchester colleges, but they rejected it because he wanted it ring fenced for white working class boys scholarships. I mean, is this the sort of thing that people should be looking at, or is there a danger here that you end up creating more problems by trying to, again, kind of like treat white working class boys as another minority who need to be boosted up by all these means?
I think the Equality Act should just be repealed in full. I mean, it was left there by Harriet Harman and Gordon Brown as a kind of a final blow to conservatism. I hate the idea of positive discrimination. I can see some use for it in America or South Africa or places where, you know, you've got centuries of such entrenched, you know, legal discrimination, slavery and so on. But I could possibly see a need for it there to kind of correct things. But in Britain, I don't really see a need for it, certainly not in 2020. So I can see what Ben's trying to do. He's trying to, you know, turn the tables, I guess, using the Equality Act. But I don't think there's anything to be gained by creating more quotas, more targets for white working class. Just treat everybody equally, mm-hmm. you know, which is ironically not what the Equality Act does.
And Brendan, just before we close out, just wanted to get your thoughts on one thing that Chris raises, which is a very contentious issue whenever you're talking about inequalities, which is the question of culture, which is this question of, again, I think at one point in your piece, Chris, you're talking to a teacher who says in relation to white working class boys not doing so well, he's like, well, girls work harder, they keep quiet in class, and immigrant parents are more strict. Is that something that also needs to be talked about, this in put into the mix, insofar as are there kind of certain cultural issues that need to be addressed alongside some of the class things that we've been talking about?
Definitely. I think there's a huge cultural dynamic here, which, you know, there's a temptation when anyone says something like that, it sounds like you're blaming individual families and you're blaming, you know, working class dads and working class mums for being useless, or council estates for being horrible places. It's obviously broader than that. It seems pretty clear to me that immigrant communities have more drive at the moment. The chief of Ofsted made this point a couple of years ago. She said white working class boys often lack the kind of aspiration that immigrant kids have, or the descendant of immigrant kids. You can see that even within white communities. I mean, Irish kids tend to do a bit better than native working class kids. Polish kids were doing well for a while, I think. I'm not sure if that's still the case. But even within white communities, there are differentials. So that does suggest there's a cultural dynamic to this. I think, you know, there has been a relentless diminishing of working class horizons over the past couple of decades. And there has been a relentless demonization of that section of society. And that has an impact. You know, if you constantly go on about the fact that these people are chavs, or they're probably racist, like all white people are racist, they're privileged, they've got everything going for them in life, even though that's categorically untrue. You know, this kind of constant media and political problematization of that section of society, you know, the natives are just these horrid people who need to have their awareness raised, their weight reduced, their parenting skills improved, their children clipped around the ear hole for being useless lumps. I mean, that has been the message for a long time. And I think that just has this baleful impact on certain sections of society in terms of diminishing their horizons. So I'm with Chris, you know, repeal the Equality Act. It's pointless and stupid and doesn't do anything to improve equality. We do have to, however, go back to a situation where we encourage high aspirations amongst all communities. And I think that really is the only way to tackle this. Equality of opportunity and equality of aspiration. If we can manifest those things, I think we'll be in a better position.
Last Orders, like all of Spike's podcasts, is free. There are no subscriptions, bonus episodes for paying customers. We want to reach as many people as possible. But to help us do so, we rely on the generosity of our listeners. So if you enjoy the show and have a bit of money to spare, please do consider making a donation. Anything you can give is greatly appreciated. Now, back to the show. So let's move on to our next topic, which is Boris Johnson and his obesity strategy. So Johnson was once hailed as a bit of a libertarian, an enemy of the nanny state. But after his nearish death experience with coronavirus, he's on a bit of a health kick and he seems to be enforcing it on the rest of us. So the strategy was published in this past week, lays out all manner of measures to reduce consumption of unhealthy food, you know, bans on junk food advertising, pre-watershed, more calorie labels, and also inevitable, it seems, with this government, an app. But will any of it make the blindest bit of difference? Chris, do you want to give us your assessment of all of this? You know, how much of this is new, and what impact do you think it's going to have?
Yeah, well, I mean, he's hailed as a libertarian, but I can't actually think of anything he's ever done that's been libertarian. Can you? I mean, as Mayor of London for so long and Prime Minister for a year, what's he actually done that's libertarian?
The first thing he did was introduce that ban on drinking on the tube, as far as I remember.
So. Yeah, exactly. He introduced that, and as a Prime Minister, he put us all under house arrest for 4 months, and now he's doing this. I mean, I'm not sure this is a deserved reputation, to be honest. To answer your question, none of it's new, really. It's nearly all the child obesity plan that Cameron actually came up with in his final months, which was then ditched by Theresa May. The only good thing Fiona Hill ever did as her advisor was to get rid of all that stuff. And no one really missed it. And then, because Action on Sugar, who did miss it, complained and Jamie Oliver complained, Ney being quite weak, gave in and brought it back. And then, of course, we got rid of her and it became Boris's problem. And he was able to kick it in the long grass, really, because of Brexit and COVID. And then he supposedly had this deathbed conversion to paternalism and decided we all need to get on our bikes and not see adverts for olive oil and cheese. So that's what he's brought in. It's actually worse than Theresa May's, because although a lot of people have been talking about the advertising ban and a few of the other things, calorie labeling and so on, actually, I think the worst and most pernicious aspect of it is the total ban on internet advertising for so-called junk food, which isn't junk food. It's most food, really. Because, I mean, digital advertising, I think, makes up about half total advertising spend. I think it's probably bigger than all of the forms of advertising combined, and it's only going to grow more, right? It is the present and future of marketing. The definition of junk food is much, much broader than people realized. I think some people are waking up to that now. So this means, and this is a total ban, this is not even a watershed ban, this is 24 hours a day. This means whatever you're selling, from Burger King to a local artisan company that makes pate or marmalade, I mean, they can never communicate with potential consumers in any online form at any time of day ever again. I mean, this is a massive infringement of freedom of speech. And that's what it really comes down to. This is a freedom of speech issue. And people don't look at advertising enough as being a freedom of speech issue. We need a First Amendment in this country for a lot of reasons. I mean, freedom of speech in general is under attack like it's never been in my lifetime. And this attack on commercial speech is absolutely part of it, in my opinion.
Brendan, what's your thoughts on all this?
I have to say, I find this obesity strategy really quite scary and actually quite repulsive. Firstly, it's ridiculous because it's been launched at the same time as the eat out to help out thing. So, you know, do they want us to go and eat food on the cheap, or do they want us to starve ourselves and just ride a bike around all day? So it's confusing, but it's also taking place at the same time that there have been quite a few statistics suggesting that poorer kids have been going out without meals during the lockdown or have not been eaten as nutritiously as they might otherwise have done because parents aren't working as much. Money has been tight. People know they're going to lose their job. So you have this dual situation where on the one hand, we talk about food banks. We talk about the lack of nutrition during the lockdown. And then you have this kind of anti-fatness, this obsessive myopic focus on how grotesque and fat people are getting, and they're all eating the wrong food. It's so confusing, but it's confusing in a way that is kind of actually quite decadent and horrible. Mm. You wake up thinking, you know, what are they going to say to the population today? Are they going to tell us we're all fat lumps who need to lose weight? Or are they going to remind us that people have been going out without meals during lockdown? You know, what will be the focus of the next 24 hours of rolling media discussion? The depressing side of it, I completely agree with Chris. I think Boris's reputation as a libertarian is unearned. You know, he may have written a couple of columns in the past slagging off the nanny state, but there's not really much evidence that he's a freedom fighter. That's very true. I still find this, however, really depressing because it makes me wonder if politics can ever move away from this sphere of life. It's been so relentless now, you know, to such an extent that millions and millions of people vote for Boris in December and end up with Tony Blair or Jamie Oliver. You know, that's who we now have. That outlook is now running the country. And so I have been wondering, what will it take to shift politicians' focus away from this area of life that should be none of their business? It's not their business what we eat. It's not their business what we exercise. And this isn't even a kind of, you know, crazy libertarian point. This is a point that goes right back to the origins of the Enlightenment itself. If you read John Locke on tolerance, he raises the issue, should officialdom have the right to interfere in someone's life if they are potentially harming themselves? And of course, John Stuart Mill develops that point later on in the 1800s. And they both say, no, forget it, leave them alone. You know, freedom is too important for that kind of interference. If they're harming someone else, knock yourself out, stop them from doing it. But if this is a question of people having bad habits or eating unhealthily or putting on too much weight, that's not the government's business. We just have to find a way to make it much more commonly accepted that it is not the government's business to stick its nose into any areas of life. So that's the thing that's troubling my mind at the moment. It's become such, suddenly in the influential sections of society, it's become so broadly accepted that this is the business of government. I do feel slightly down about the potential of shaking them out of that and making them realize this is none of their business whatsoever.
Chris, feel free to come back on any of that. But I also wanted to ask you about where you think this is headed, because we've talked a bit about on this podcast previously about some of the food reformulation scheme that's going on in the background. You've pointed out that for a long time, it felt like public health were trying to treat food as the new tobacco. And, you know, given the fact that the clampdown on smoking began, I think, with a 9 p.m. pre-watershed ban on advertising, are we headed towards a situation where beyond this stuff, which is kind of repackaged things that already existed or kind of gold plating restrictions that had already been put in place, are we going to see more and more things that are going to get more and more limiting in terms of people's choices with how they eat and whatnot?
Yes, it's a slippery slope. It's what I've been warning people about for the last 15 years, and no one pays any bloody attention. I quoted something from a debate, parliamentary debate, way back in 1963, because you're quite right. The whole anti-tobacco crusade began with a 9 p.m. watershed ban on TV advertising. And look where we are now. And my basic argument is we will end up in the same position with food in however long, if we continue on this path. And I don't see any reason why we wouldn't do. And this is the point. The bit I quoted was an MP who didn't see the logic in a 9 p.m. ban. They wanted a total ban. And he said something along the lines of, look, the principle here has been conceded that it is a good thing that people don't see tobacco advertising. Therefore, why are we allowing it after 9 p.m.? And of course, after that, it was why we're allowing it in magazines and on billboards, and why are we allowing it cigarettes to be displayed in shops, and finally, why are we allowing cigarette companies to even have colors and logos on their packets? And he was right. The principle has been conceded. Now, you might say, oh, probably not you two, but some listeners might think, you know, fair enough, that was tobacco. But the argument at the time was, this is a unique product. And the people who opposed these kind of interventions said, I don't see any reason why there wouldn't be a slippery slope. Now, who's been proven right, ultimately, right? I think the libertarians called that one right. Can I just say that let's just take a moment to stand in amazement at how public health have turned this around. You know, we're still in the middle of a pandemic, and yet we're talking about Percy Pigs, or we were this week. Henry Dimbleby's got a bee in his bonnet about Percy Pigs. We're talking about obesity. Public Health England have failed in every conceivable way. And this, it should be abolished and perhaps may yet be abolished. Even if it is abolished, it's still managed to get this through. And this is a thing it's been really after for years. This is a thing it's interested in. It's not interested in virology. It's interested in cheese and burgers and chips, you know? And so somehow they have managed to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat. Everyone should be talking about what a disgrace Public Health England is and working out how we can stop people getting infected with the virus rather than how we can have slightly fewer fat people who might be a bit less likely to die if they get the virus. Never mind, you know, this is really fiddling while Rome burns. I mean, aside from anything else, people aren't going to lose weight in time for the second wave anyway. All this COVID stuff is just a distraction and an excuse to do what the government's been wanting to do all along. But at least, as Brendan says, at least even if they're banning buy one, get one free deals, the government's giving us our food half price anyway.
Hi, I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. And if you are, why not take a second to leave us a rating and a review with your podcast provider? It takes just 30 seconds and is a great way to help us reach new people. Now, on with the show. So let's move on to our final topic, which is coronavirus and the masks debate. So for about the past week now, it's been mandatory to wear face coverings in shops in England, and it's proved quite controversial. So some see this as a sensible public health measure. If anything, it should have been introduced ages ago, while others say this is an infringement on our liberties. It's based on very thin evidence. At its margins, I think it's fair to say this debate has taken on a little bit of a culture war aspect to them. You've got lockdown fanatic Twitterers just saying to skeptics, you know, put the fucking mask on whenever they voice any criticism. And there's some of the more colourful lockdown skeptics, shall we say, have been staging little selfie protests in supermarkets. But beyond all of that, there's obviously a core issue here about how the state relates to us under coronavirus and whether or not these measures are actually warranted. Brendan, to kick things off, what's your take on the mask debate and how you've seen it play out?
I hate masks. I really hate them. They're not comfortable and they make me feel claustrophobic. And I keep forgetting to put mine on when I go into a shop. So I've been told off by security guards so many times, and that's really irritating. I don't like them. And I think there are lots of question marks over the mandatory mask wearing policy. And I think people should be perfectly at liberty to ask those questions without being accused of wanting to kill old people, which is the, you know, that's been the shape of the discussion so far. You know, there are lots of question marks. COVID is declining. You know, maybe it's coming back in parts of the country, which to a certain extent, which would not be particularly surprising because we're all outdoors, possibly. But the thing is, it is definitely on the way out. The number of infections and the number of deaths have plummeted over recent weeks and months. And yet suddenly it's mandatory to wear a mask to Morrisons, where it wasn't 3 months ago when we were all going to Morrisons still, and when COVID was pretty rampant. So that doesn't make sense. There's also a discussion about the efficacy of masks. You know, some masks are probably pretty decent. Others probably do not protect you from the virus as much as you would like to think. So the jury is still out on the efficacy of masks in terms of preventing the spread of virus. So there are lots of question marks. The thing is, I just find it all very symbolic. I think masks have become a metaphor for contempt for ordinary people. You know, illness always comes with metaphor. There's a point, Susan Sontag wrote a great essay in 1978, Illness as Metaphor. And then she followed it up with a piece on AIDS and its metaphors in 1989. Just looking at how illness is never illness. There's always baggage. You know, it always gets politicized or moralized in some way. The masses are seen as diseased and sex is seen as dangerous and all those kind of things. There's always a moral baggage with these kinds of sicknesses. And I think that's the case with COVID and masks. I think a lot of the people, you know, George Monbiot tweeting, "You don't have the human right to breathe your germs on me." I think that actually says a lot more about him and his section of society than it does about ordinary people or the possibility of catching COVID. There's this real sense of self-atomization and this desire of people just to cut themselves off from the diseased public. And so I think a lot of the pro-mask sentiment is driven not by hard science, but by just the wariness of other people.
And Chris, what's your take on the mask debate?
Well, I might get kicked out of the Libertarian Club for saying this, but I really don't see what the big deal is about wearing a mask when you go to the shops. You know, if it's that much of a burden to you, you are going shopping way too much. You know, and just pop out to the shops, stick the mask on, go in, get some milk and come out and can take the mask off again. This is not really the hill to die on, as I say. With regards to whether they work, it seems to me they do. It seems to me that places like Taiwan and Japan that have kept this virus under control without having to go into lockdown have worn masks. The very fact that we were told that masks didn't work in this kind of noble lie, which, by the way, is really the reason they didn't make this mandatory earlier, because there was a global shortage of masks. So the PHE and the World Health Organization all lied to us about masks not providing any benefit. You know, don't buy them because the medics need them. Well, why do the medics need them if they don't provide any benefit? I mean, it's a pretty obvious hole in the argument, right? They definitely have some effect. It's quite difficult to prove that, I guess, and you can't do randomized control trials, but the evidence seems to be pretty good, actually. I mean, apart from anything else, it's common sense that they have some benefit. Should they be mandatory? Well, maybe there's a danger of a slippery slope here. You know, maybe they'll make us wear them all the time, but I don't think that's realistically going to happen. I'm not sure when Brandon says, you know, the virus disappeared. It could easily come back. There have been resurgences. It doesn't seem that enough people have got the antibodies for us to be very confident that it's not going to come back in winter. And so the priority has to be to stop a massive second wave that causes us to go into a winter lockdown, which would just be hellish beyond words. And if masks can help us do that, then I'm not against having to wear one in a shop every now and again. I think people complaining about it are being crybabies.
So, Brendan, feel free to respond to that particular accusation. But also, I guess the civil liberties question as well is an interesting one. Is this something which is going to be part of this nebulous new normal that we still talk about, we endlessly talk about? Is there a slippery slope here, do you think?
I mean, that's the core point. I actually agree that it's not the hill to die on. And, you know, those kind of anti-mask, ever so slightly conspiracy theory types, you know, the obsessive anti-lockdown people who... the 5G types, you know, and they're doing their protests with them.
Peter Hitchens with his gas mask. It makes it look totally sane and reasonable, that, doesn't it?
But, you know, the ones who are cutting a hole in their mask and then going protesting in Hyde Park and all that. I mean, that's nutty. That's weird. And it's also weird to say, I demand my civil liberty not to wear a mask. I mean, that's a weird thing to say. But your point, Tom, I think is the right one, which is the thing that concerns me is the development of a new normal. I hate that phrase. I mean, I think it's incredibly undemocratic and authoritarian. Who decides what the new normal is? Why is there not more public discussion about what it ought to be and whether it should even exist. I feel like that's an imposition. And so when you hear public health experts saying not shaking hands is the new normal, no more hugging is the new normal, face masks are the new normal, that stuff worries me enormously. Because when I go out now on the streets or in a shop or in a pub, you know, my local pub still has not recovered in terms of numbers. It's very quiet on a Saturday compared with pre-lockdown. People are not going out. People are scared. I don't think that's because of masks. You don't have to wear a mask in a pub, but it's because of the new normal and this insistence that normal life as we knew it previously cannot come back. And you have to be super careful all the time. That, I think, is having a very destructive impact on society, the culture of freedom, and on economic life. And that's what we should be worried about. I think masks send the message that everyone else is a diseased person. You know, there is nothing more depressing at the moment than getting on the tube and everyone is sitting four seats apart with a mask on. And your instinct is to think that's a dangerous person. I shouldn't go near them. I shouldn't let them take their mask off and talk to me. If they smile at me, that's dangerous. It does feed into a broader culture of fear. And that's why I would question making mask wearing mandatory. But my bigger issue is the new normal, which I think will be illiberal and depressing and very bad for economic life.
Chris, just finally, it was pretty widely reported that part of the reason that the government changed their mind on this, aside from the evidence such as it was presented, had changed slightly, but was also the question of encouraging people to go back out to try and start repairing some of the economic damage done. Do you think it's going to work on that front, given what Brendan's just said?
I don't really know, because obviously it could equally put people off. I mean, it can certainly put people off shopping, because I've done the same thing as Brendan, is go out to the shop and then realize I've got a mask on. So I don't go in the shop and go to the pub instead. So, yeah, I mean, does it create a culture of security or a culture of fear? I really genuinely don't know. But it doesn't really matter what the government tells us or, you know, makes us do from now on. It has already terrified people. Amazing opinion poll came out this week showing that people in Britain think that 100 times more people have died from COVID than actually have. So people are in genuine fear. And part of that is a legitimate response to the virus, but I think most of it is a response to the government ramping up the fear in order to make sure people went along with the lockdown in the first place. And it's going to be extremely difficult for them to undo that. I mean, I'm extremely pessimistic about everything, as I may have said before on this podcast. I mean, I think we're heading for 4 or 5 million people unemployed, unbelievable amounts of debt, quite possibly a devastating second wave, and also a population that I've really lost much faith in. You know, the general response to this, the screaming and hysteria about people sunbathing in a park or going to Bournemouth Beach. I mean, and also the fact, to be honest, the way they've gone along with all this nanny state stuff this week, it's a smaller issue, I guess. But I just don't see much hope either socially or economically for this country. I think we're a clown country. The fact that we're talking about Percy Pigs in the middle of a pandemic is the final proof of that, as far as I'm concerned.
I think that's a fittingly bleak point on which to end it. Chris, Brendan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheers.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to give us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to help support Spiked to keep us making this podcast and all our other podcasts, as well as our daily articles and essays, then please do consider making a donation. It's really easy to do. Just go to spiked-online.com and hit that big red donate button in the top right corner. Anything you can spare is greatly appreciated. Thanks for listening and see you next time.